Blog Talk Radio.
To research at the National Archives and Beyond Blog Talk Radio. This is your host, Bernice Alexander Bennett. I want to welcome our callers and chatters to research at the National Archives and Beyond. This show will provide individuals interested in genealogy an opportunity to listen, learn, and take action. You can join me every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, where I will have a wonderful lineup of experts who will share resources, stories, and answer your burning genealogy questions. All of my guests share a deep passion and knowledge of genealogy and history. If you have logged in as a guest and wish to participate in the chat, you can sign in through your Facebook account or Blog Talk Radio. I will also open the lines in the second half of the show so that you can ask questions of the guests. You can also continue this discussion on afrogenius.com, following the show by adding comments and other resources in the genealogy and history section. Now, how many of you have explored the local history of your community or the community of your ancestors? Well, my guest tonight, Wilhelmina Rhodes Kelly, has done just that. She has so much passion for her beloved community, and she will share with you the African American's presence in Brooklyn. Wilhelmina is a third-generation Brooklyn native with roots in both Bedford-Stuyvesant and Crown Heights. Her family research led her to discover hidden foundations of Brooklyn history and the vanishing roots of Central Brooklyn in particular. This moved her to write a book titled Bedford-Stuyvesant in 2007 and a second book titled Crown Heights and Weeksville in 2010. Wilhelmina conducts periodic tours of the 1787 Aramis Hall Academy building in Flatbush and is dedicated to the preservation of historic structures and burial grounds in Brooklyn and Queens. So let me give a warm welcome to Wilhelmina Rhodes Kelly to research at the National Archives and Beyond. Wilhelmina, welcome.
Well, thank you very much, Bernice. It's very nice to be talking with you.
Well, I enjoyed talking with you the other day. You just are so excited about your community, about Brooklyn. And
that's
since
true.
You are a third-generation native of Brooklyn, please share with us what led you to explore the local history of your community.
Well, I have always had an interest in my family history and had been asking questions from when I was about 10 years old. And I grew up in Bed-Stuy and then at about 12 years old moved to Crown Heights. So I wasn't really asking questions about the local history so much as I was asking questions of my grandparents who were born in the 1890s and my mom who was born in the 1920s. About what it was like to have come from the South. And when I got older, and I guess about 10 years ago, I began to explore my family history. And in finding out more about my grandparents and my mother's presence in Brooklyn, I discovered how much local history had been really forgotten and overlooked over the years. So I was just amazed that the history went back to the Revolutionary War, and I began to really search, and there was such a wealth of information, I finally wound up writing a book.
Okay, well, why don't you help all of us understand? Just give us a basic overview of Brooklyn as far back as you can describe.
Okay, well, Brooklyn was basically settled by the Dutch, and that was in the 1630s. I was always under the impression that Brooklyn and Manhattan were the early settlements and the first settlements by the Dutch, but actually they settled Albany first, and then they settled Brooklyn. And they settled Bedford-Stuyvesant, or what was known as the town of Bedford or the village of Bedford, in 1650. So Bedford and the succeeding town of Bedford-Stuyvesant really had its beginning with the Dutch in the 1650s, and then the British took over in the 1664, and then it evolved over the years into a brownstone community, but from 1664, when the British took over and when they started building the brownstones for which Bedford-Stuyvesant is known, that wasn't until about 1880, 1860. So there was a whole period there where Bedford was basically a farming community and supplied food for the local population and for the residents in Manhattan. So it's really a Dutch, has a Dutch and an English foundation.
And so from what you have learned, when did the African-American presence become evident in the Brooklyn communities?
Well, the remarkable thing is, and I grew up in Brooklyn, and my mom was born in Brooklyn, and her mother was also born in Brooklyn in 1903, and never really realized that from the very early settlements in the 1600s that there was an African-American presence in Brooklyn. They were in Flatbush, they were in Bedford, they were in what is now East New York. They certainly were in downtown Brooklyn near the water, near the earliest settlements right across the river from Manhattan. So they were actually a part of the Dutch household. They went to the Dutch churches. They spoke the Dutch language. They adopted the culture of the Dutch, and just continued to live in that Brooklyn community, but largely undocumented because of slavery. They didn't really name the enslaved population, so they were sort of in the background, but still very much of a presence.
Mm-hmm. Now, if you had to describe Brooklyn, you said town. Were there many townships, or was it just one big town?
No, well, actually, there were six original townships or towns that comprise what is today the borough of Brooklyn. There's the town of Brooklyn. There was Bushwick. There was New Utrecht, Flatbush, Flatlands, and basically the British settled Gravesend. So we had those six original towns, which grew over time and finally united into one borough recognized by as a part of New York City. But they all started out as separate townships and then began to work as one community.
Mm-hmm. Well, with each township, was there a particular ethnic group associated with each of the six township?
Yes, well, actually, the Dutch, as I had mentioned earlier, were a large presence in Brooklyn and in Flatbush and in what later became that central area of Brooklyn of Crown Heights. And the Dutch owned a lot of the farmland that was a friable soil that allowed them to plant and have good produce. But they were pretty much interlinked by the Dutch settlement. They had that Dutch foundation, and the Dutch churches were very much part of that early settlement of Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm. So, but eventually, what other groups moved into the community, or are we not quite there yet?
No. Actually, from about the early 1600s, when the Dutch moved in, to a very short period in 1664 when the British took over. And it was a very peaceful takeover in that the population was pretty much dissatisfied with Peter Stuyvesant, who was the Dutch governor, and were ready for were not as resistant to a change under British leadership. But as far as people of color were concerned, it was a major change because the Dutch pretty much embraced or welcomed the participation of blacks in the Dutch culture, and that included not only going to church and having specific pews pretty much in the back, not wholly embraced, but definitely a part of that of that going to church and the Sabbath. But they also, the Dutch, felt that education was important, and educated the enslaved and made it possible for free blacks to also gain an education. When the British took over in 1664, that stopped. If mm-hmm. you wanted an education under the British, you had to pay for it. So mm-hmm. Blacks really had a little setback with the British. And until, 1776 and that whole Battle of Brooklyn, that first battle in the Revolutionary War, it was pretty much, the British were running things as they saw fit and treating the local population, and that included the native Europeans and the African Americans as second-class British citizens.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So there was, that transition from the British presence. The Germans came in at the time of the Revolutionary War in large numbers because they were part of the British troops in mm-hmm. a deal that the British made with the Germans. So they were Hessian troops, and the Irish came in about in the 1840s and after the emancipation of African Americans in New York in 1827. So from 1664 to 1827, people of color who were enslaved really were just having to make do until they gained their freedom at that time.
Mhm. Mhm. So you mentioned the church. At
mm-hmm.
that time, you mentioned the Dutch church. But what about, mm-hmm. is there anything you can tell us about the black churches? Since you said something about gaining their freedom, and you said 1827.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes. Well, the blacks continue to pretty much speak the Dutch language, and the British allowed the Dutch to continue their culture up until you know, the revolution, and when the British actually finally wound up leaving. But they were, the blacks pretty much went to the Dutch, churches until in the 1700s when the AME Church, Bridge Street Church actually, was founded in 1766 in downtown Brooklyn, and that's the AWME Church. So, but they pretty much had a Dutch culture and Dutch language. And it wasn't until after, leading up to the emancipation in 1827 that African Americans in Brooklyn began to create their own, go to their own churches, found their own churches, created their own schools, their own colored schools, their orphanages, old folks' homes, even their own burial grounds. So it was with the emancipation of blacks in 1827 that we began to really recognize and be able to follow the demographic of blacks in Brooklyn.
So what was black life like in Brooklyn from that period, say, until after the Civil War?
During the time that the British had were in control, it was basically an agricultural community. Brooklyn really didn't start developing as a city until at least the 1850s, and certainly the development of Bedford-Stuyvesant and the urbanization of Bed-Stuy began to really take off when the descendants of those early Dutch settlers began to sell their farms, large farms, and that's where you have those row houses, because they were acres of land that was suddenly available, and they were right in a part of Brooklyn that was developing a train system and a trolley system, and they'd have, you know, access to a transportation. The water and the wells were being eliminated, and they were finally putting in the water pipes. So it was the developing community, and at that time, coincidentally, they began to sell off that, Dutch descendants started selling off that land. So that really helped in the development of Bed-Stuy. But it stayed an agricultural community for many, many years. Even after the British left and America started to develop on its own.
So let's move into, let's say, the 1870s and beyond. What can you tell me about the development of the various townships and Bed-Stuy and Wicksville and the other communities?
Well, with that 1827 emancipation and the creation of Wicksville, which is in central Brooklyn, and it's really now almost part of Crown Heights. They bought James Weeks was one of the earliest purchasers of land, which he sold in lots. And blacks with their newfound freedom functioned as so many other communities did in Brooklyn, and it was pretty common for different nationalities and ethnic groups to take care of their own community members, and that by that I mean they had their own churches. I'm talking the Dutch descendants, the English descendants, the German descendants, even the Swedish descendants, they had, and the Jewish population. They have their churches and their newspapers and their orphanages, and everybody pretty much lived within their own community. If you were a person of color and you moved to and you were in Brooklyn, you pretty much lived in specific areas. Maybe you lived in Williamsburg, you lived in Bedford, you lived in Weeksville, you lived in downtown Brooklyn, but you didn't just pick up and say, oh, I think I'm going to go live in, you know, Gravesend. You weren't going to live there because that wasn't, quote, your community.
Mm-hmm. Now, what was the race relationships like in the various townships?
Well, it was strained. In that if someone was traveling from Bedford and was going down to work in shipping or with boats or stevedore, you had to find transportation to get down there, a stagecoach, really. Mm-hmm. And you weren't always allowed on the stagecoach. You had to walk.
Mm-hmm.
Needless to say, you know, the opportunities to really prosper were limited because there was that stigma of having been formerly enslaved or a descendant of someone formerly enslaved. So there was always that issue. And then when the Irish began to come in about the 1840s with the potato famine in larger numbers at least, and right up to the Civil War, there was competition for those jobs that blacks had had before. And that was also, you know, very stressful. And It was difficult trying to keep the peace because it was just a struggle to try to make ends meet.
Well, you know what we're going to do? We're going to take a quick break and come back and let's talk about the migration of individuals from the South. Okay.
All right. Okay.
And I have a special song to play for you right now. You know, I couldn't get Alicia Keys to come on and sing her song, but I do have a special New York song, okay?
Okay,
quick
terrific.
Break.
Great.
In Central Park, hang out on the gray lawn, check out concerts there, dance like you just don't care. The bright Harlem light, Apollo show tonight, there's so much to do. Summer in New York, summer in New York, summer in New York, summer in New York. There's much excitement there. I hate to say it's groovy,
but it's groovy, baby.
On Queens Boulevard, check out shopping malls.
it's Coney Isle for a roller coaster ride. That's where I met you. Summer in your. Summer in New York.
It's summer in New York.
It's summer in New York. You and I can do what we love to do. Like them Brian Paul, all right here. Summer in New York.
It's summer in New York.
It's summer in New York.
Summer in New York.
Baby.
At the National Archives and Beyond Blog Talk Radio. You're listening to Wilhelmina Rhodes Kelly, and she is going to now share with us when the migration of individuals from the South became evident in Brooklyn. And Wilhelmina, that was your song, okay?
Well, I loved it. It was great. Thank you.
So share with us, when did the migration become evident?
Well, the migration pretty much started about 1900, when there really was a sharp increase of African Americans moving from the South to cities in the North, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., and Brooklyn and Manhattan. And it really became evident, and as I had said earlier, that you really lived in a certain community. Blacks and other ethnic groups really much stuck together. So if you were going to move to New York, you went to Bedford-Stuyvesant or you went to Williamsburg. And it really became evident and became an issue for people living in Bedford about in the 1920s and the 1930s. And the European population began to take issue and try to keep them out of the neighborhood, not allowing them to rent, not allowing them to buy. And it was around that time that my own grandparents, my father's mother and father, came from South Carolina in 1930. They went to Flushing first because it's a Quaker town and was rumored to be more accepting of people of color. And then eventually moved to Brooklyn. And with the release of the 1940 census, by the way, just this month, I found them in Bedford-Stuyvesant on Putnam Avenue. So they were living in Bed-Stuy in 1940 in a home that they had purchased. But before that, there was an organization called the Gates Avenue Association, and they were had banded together to try to keep blacks out of the neighborhood. So it was Bedford-Stuyvesant in the 30s, was not the easiest place to live. And even my grandmother and her sisters and brothers, who I got to know because they all lived in the neighborhood and we lived within walking distance of each other, and they told stories about how they were treated unequally, let me say. So it wasn't the easiest thing, but they made do, and they were able to live a life that they felt was sufficient and satisfying for them.
Well, we have a question coming out of the chat, and they wanted to know if certain parts of Brooklyn reflected specific states where people migrated from.
Well, I would not, it's not to my knowledge, I'll put it that way. I went to Concord Baptist Church,
mm-hmm.
and the church had different clubs. There was the South Carolina Club, and there was the Virginia Club, and there was,
mm-hmm.
You know, they were from different parts of the South, but they pretty much lived within the same community.
Mm-hmm.
So I wouldn't say, no, this section is just specifically South Carolinians or Virginians. No, I wouldn't say that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, not to my knowledge.
Not to your knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
But the club, and I've even observed that in Washington, D.C., at some of the churches, they have like the South Carolina Club and the
mm-hmm.
Virginia Club and what have you. So that was
right.
a way of keeping that kinship and that, I guess, that arm back in the South, too.
Absolutely.
From what I understand, with some of the migratory patterns, you would have one family member go and pretty much stake claim in the area and then bring the others up.
Mm-hmm,
was that
mm-hmm.
a similar type of movement pattern that occurred with your family?
Yes, absolutely. My grandmother came up to Flushing in 1930, and her family followed a year later. And although she had been trained as a teacher in a one-room schoolhouse in Barnwell, South Carolina, when she came to New York, in spite of her education, she worked as a maid for a family
mm-hmm.
in
mm-hmm.
Flushing.
Mm-hmm.
So, but they did, definitely someone came first, and she was actually following her sister, who was living in Flushing, and they shared that apartment, and then they moved to Bed-Stuy, and they had houses across the street from each other
mm-hmm.
on Jefferson Avenue in Bed-Stuy.
And what was their general reaction to life in Brooklyn versus, you said, Barnwell, South Carolina?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I had asked my grandmother about that when I was a girl and became aware that the South could be supposedly more discriminatory than in the North, and I asked how she was treated, and she said that she was not mistreated because they had been living on that farm, had owned that farm for generations, and well, I wouldn't say generations, for decades, and were known and respected, and they did not have issues that forced them to have to leave. They were looking for education. They were looking for employment opportunities outside of farming.
Mm-hmm.
So they settled into to Brooklyn, and a couple of her sisters had already been living in a town in Augusta, Georgia, which is right across the Savannah River from Barnwell. So they were already accustomed to living in a city environment. So
mm-hmm.
they settled into Brooklyn pretty painlessly.
Yes. Well, did you, you know, document their reaction, or do you have any letters that they sent home? Was anything ever put in the newspaper, a social report of something that you have uncovered in your research about your family?
Well, I did not discover any letters because my grandmother's sisters and brothers, and they were all born between 1891 and 1899, and I got to know them, and I decided when I was researching the family history that I would document their thoughts and their personalities and little vignettes about their years and their thoughts in the city. And they had their you know, there was a degree of discrimination, but not to the point where they felt that they would have to go back home.
Mm-hmm.
But I did document their history and their children and what their thoughts were about living in the North.
Mm-hmm. Now you mentioned, they were there between 1901 and did some of the migration from 1901, let's say 1930. What was life like, and how did they compare Brooklyn to Harlem?
Well, we were really Brooklynites, and we had, from what I understand and from what my mother has told me, and my grandparents, that Brooklyn was considered the country, the quiet township that people really, if they were looking for a lively social life, they weren't really going to find it in Brooklyn. And as
okay.
a matter of fact, people who lived in Harlem and were going to take a trip to Brooklyn said, actually, I'm taking a trip to the country, and everybody knew that they were going to Brooklyn.
Okay.
So they were two very distinct communities that they did not have like a Harlem Renaissance that they in Bed-Stuy, nothing like that as far as I know.
Mm-hmm. Was it a little more quiet
type of
socialization?
Mm-hmm. It was more quiet. It was a family community where most people, and I'm talking from my own perspective now, 1950s, 1960s Bed-Stuy, where you knew your neighbors and you knew the policemen who actually walked the beat, as they used to say. You knew the grocery, you knew the A&P. It was a community where you were part of an extended family, and my grandmother's sisters and brothers all lived around us. So it was a happy time to be growing up in Brooklyn in the 50s.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's another question coming out of the chat. What was the big draw to New York? Was it the livelihood, or why did people go there?
Well, people came to New York for educational opportunity and for employment opportunity. And from what I understand, there was also a segment of the population that came from the South who were good with and training and feeding and caring for horses. They had racetracks in New York, in Brooklyn,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
down at Sheepshead Bay and out in Queens. And the men from South Carolina were known to know how to care for horses. So that's just a small segment, but it was known that you could get a good education in Brooklyn. And my dad, who was born in 1921, was born in South Carolina, and he went to Boys High. He went to the old PS 44 and then went to Boys High and got a great education. And there was a wonderful opportunity to be well educated through the New York school system at that time. And my mother would often mention that, you know, she received an excellent education. So there was that as well. And
was this through the public education?
Yes, this is a public school public education. Yes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you able to you know, to find employment after being educated through the Brooklyn Board of Ed.
Great. So that definitely made a difference. Yeah.
Yes,
so when did you observe the migration of the West Indian groups to Brooklyn?
Well, I went to Erasmus Hall and in the 60s. I graduated in 64. And I went with the students in my class were from various ethnic groups. They were Italian and German descendants and basically European, African American, and some from the Caribbean, a small
mm-hmm.
number. But, yes, they were a part of Erasmus Hall. And sometime between, I would say, the late 60s to the late 70s, there was a an increase in the number of people from the Caribbean, particularly in Flatbush, where Erasmus Hall is located and, of course, was settled by the Dutch. And when the Dutch were living there with their slaves, many of those slaves came from the Caribbean. And it's almost as if Flatbush has come full circle. They
mm-hmm.
were there from the 1650s and then became a very large part demographic of Flatbush in the 70s and 80s. So you really began to see it in, I would say, the in the late 70s. Particularly, they moved the parade, the Caribbean Day Parade, to Eastern Parkway, and there was a tremendous population. And I believe my mother tells me they used to have a parade, West Indian Day Parade, on Bedford Avenue, and then it became so large that it was moved to Eastern Parkway, and it was just a huge affair from about the mid-70s and forward up to today.
Mm-hmm. Now, there was a point in time, and I'm just going to share with those of you who are listening, that Wilhelmina and I were talking, and you mentioned something about an orphanage. Can you
mm-hmm.
say a little bit more about the orphanage? Because those who were not a part of our conversation perhaps don't know what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm referring specifically to that early Weeksville settlement in 1827, right after the emancipation of blacks in Brooklyn, and at a time when communities really did care for the members within their radius. And Weeksville was no exception. They had their churches, they had their colored school, and they had the Howard Colored Orphanage, which was an orphanage that was created for orphans, half orphans, and even at the earliest establishment in the 1860s, 1866-67, after the Civil War, when these children found themselves parentless. And in Weeksville, they did have they did accept children who were not necessarily orphans, but were almost like a boarding school. You know, they would accept students whose parents had to work, and
mm-hmm.
So they were boarded. So that was you know, part of the process of helping the parent to find employment and also caring for their children. They also had, Weeksville had their own burial ground called the Union Cemetery, and that was on Eastern Parkway, crossed Eastern Parkway, going up Buffalo, and then they had to, when they built Eastern Parkway, they exhumed those graves and moved them out to Queens. But this was pretty common for the Catholic population, the Swedish population, the Jewish population. You had the Jewish hospitals, and you had old folks' homes as well, which they're surviving. What they used to call old folks' home on St. John's Place in Brooklyn, that started in Weeksville, still exists today. It was called a home for colored people. So it was part of that larger community and the need for people of color to care for each other.
Yes. Well, you know, I'm moving back and forth, but I do have another question coming out of the chat. The chat room. Is there still an inward migration into Brooklyn?
Well, there is a as far as African Americans with Southern roots, there has been a documented return to the South. There is a decreasing population of African Americans in New York, because they are returning to not perhaps their original townships in the South, but they are moving back to what they now call Sun Belt. So there does seem to be a diminished movement from the South to the North, and it seems to be going the other way now.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm just going to move a little further up now and just talk about your genealogical journey in Brooklyn. Have you had any surprises?
Have I had any surprises? Yes. Well, actually, what was surprising to me was that the early settlement of the Dutch included a black population, and how there was a presence of African Americans and Caribbean Americans as well in Brooklyn because of the Dutch settlement. That was amazing to me, because this is not something that they that I was taught in school, even though, you know, my entire education was in Brooklyn from, you know, elementary school right through college. And That was surprising. The early emphasis of education by the Dutch, and the opportunity to learn to read and write that the Dutch felt was an entitlement was surprising. Mm-hmm. And I did not realize that there had been a draft riot in connected with drafts for the Civil War, and that with this race riot, the black population of Manhattan left a good portion of it and moved to Weeksville, and that accounted for a spike in that population. There used to be a black orphanage on 42nd Street and Fifth Avenue, across the street from today's main branch of the New York Public Library, and it was burned to the ground in a race riot, and many of those blacks that were living in that area and parts of Manhattan took the ferries, got in their boats, and went over to Weeksville and moved there. So there was that spike in the black population because of this incident.
So Weeksville was a very protective environment and a safe place for people to go because of the race riot?
Yes. Well, they knew that this was a there were numbers of blacks that were living together, and the town was recognized as a secure community, and wound up settling there. Even my mother's father, who's from Virginia, when I was doing the family research and looked for him, John Hamlin, Reverend John Hamlin, I find him on Bergen Street, right in the heart of Weeksville. So when he came up from Virginia with a stop in Red Bank, New Jersey, he settled in Weeksville, and that was 1910. Mm-hmm. So this was where people evidently felt secure.
Yeah, and there was comfort. It was that
mm-hmm.
sounds like there was a great deal of comfort. Well, there's
absolutely.
Another question coming out of the chat, and it what
mm-hmm.
what would you do differently now that you've gotten a bit further along with your research, and what tips can you give to others who are researching their migrating ancestors?
What would I do differently?
Mm-hmm.
I would make it a point to tape my grandmother's sisters and brothers, and anyone that I was asking those idle questions at the time when I was, 10 and 12, and when I realized that this is valuable information, that oral history that they share with you may not necessarily be 100% accurate, but it has that kernel of truth. That you hear it, but you can't play it back, and you don't remember everything that someone tells you. And
mm-hmm.
I would have taped them. I would have spent more time taping, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
as they say, when an older person passes away, a library closes.
Yes.
They have such experiences, and when they're gone, that book is closed.
That book is closed. You're so right about that.
Mm-hmm.
Any other tips?
Well, I would on my journey, I would suggest that people realize that this is not something that you just you research and you say, okay, I'm done. I have my grandparents and I have my great grandparents and that's it. There's always something more to know. There's you can never assume that more family information does not exist. There is such a wealth of documented information that is available to people of color that I think that we overlook. The draft records and newspaper articles, particularly the Brooklyn Daily Eagle, which is online and was put together by the Brooklyn Public Library and is run by them. Check the paper. Look at your local history. You'd be surprised at how much by going local. You can discover more information of that uncle that died young and that missing cousin that was adopted by the wife's side of the family and then moved to another part of the country. So the idea is to be patient, but to continue to search. When I was researching my mom's side of the family out of Virginia, I had a certain element of oral history and was able to research her family based on just what she had, the few bits of information she had been told by her father, who was not a big a conversationalist with his children, and was able to get back not only to our Revolutionary War patriot, but also that family line that went back to John Rolfe and Pocahontas and from 1607, and I would have never, ever believed that that would be the case. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, there are many hundreds and hundreds of people who descend from those early years in Virginia, from John Rolfe and Pocahontas. And you have to start the journey, be patient, and just continue to work at it. And more information. It's just a quest, and it's also a gift in that information will sometimes come to you,
mm-hmm.
And you're not necessarily searching for it. So you know, you keep your ears open and just be receptive to new information, because there's so much to know. Even when you think you're done, there's still a lot to know.
Absolutely. Well, I know that you've actually written two books. And so what resources did you use to actually put together your two books?
Well, in writing the books on Bed-Stuy and Crown Heights, I used the Brooklyn Public Library photo archive, the early books, and there are excellent records, and I'm fortunate in that regard. There are many records that document events in Brooklyn, and having once been a city of its own, there is lots of information, and a famous city, by the way, there's
mm-hmm.
lots of information, land records, a wealth of information was available for Crown Heights and Bed-Stuy, including that Brooklyn Daily Eagle resource. As far as the family histories are concerned, definitely the census reports and oral history. That was
mm-hmm.
That was important in documenting the that family element as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, were any of the churches able to provide you with information about your family? As you said, your father, your grandfather was a minister?
Yes. My grandfather was a minister of Mount Lebanon Baptist Church. And the churches have great records that they were in their anniversary volumes and are able to provide a good bit of information. But in some cases, unfortunately, some of that information can be missing because you'll have a flood, you'll have a fire, they'll keep the records in their home, and
yes.
And it can be lost that way. And when someone passes away, the family inadvertently throws out the records, and that includes family members with old photos and diaries, and you know, even Bibles. They
mm-hmm.
put it out on the porch, and it gets rained on. Those kinds of things.
Right.
But, but the churches absolutely were, and historical societies and genealogical societies, they're all very helpful and just can give you tips on where to search and how to look.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact,
go ahead.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was going to ask you, is there a large community of researchers in Brooklyn that
yes,
you are
well,
aware
there,
of?
There are researchers actually across the country, and there are a number of researchers in Brooklyn. And actually, my sister Linda Jones and I run a genealogy workshop once a month through the Brooklyn Public Library at Macon branch on Lewis Avenue, and it's a part of the African Atlantic Genealogy Society, which was founded by Julius and Joycette Pierce years ago in Long Island. So we have a hands-on workshop where we help people to search and help them to get started and help them to solve any issues they may have.
Well, you have really provided us with some very interesting information concerning your love of your local community in Brooklyn. So do you any closing remarks or words of wisdom to offer others before we close out the show tonight?
I would say if you have the slightest inclination to search your family history, begin the journey. Don't hesitate, because it's not something that happens overnight. That little prompt that you're feeling to look into your family history is a clue that that you should start, because there is such great information available to you, and it will be time well spent.
Right, and it is energizing and empowering.
Absolutely, absolutely. Know your roots and to know where, you know, who you are. I wish I had known when I was in high school what I know now. Just a completely different sense of history and who I am, and our contribution to the American fabric.
That's right, and you know what? It's better late than never.
Yes, this is so true.
That's so true. Okay, well, thank you so much for joining me tonight.
Thank you, Bernice.
Yes, but we're not closing and we're not ending the show just yet.
Okay.
Because I want to just share with all of you what's happening in the month of May. You know, I have a whole new lineup ready for all of you to call in and to listen and join the chat. So did you miss Mr. Genie Blogger last Friday? Will you miss hearing him tomorrow night? Well, tune in next Thursday for a lively and informative discussion by Thomas McGinty on searching for and finding the living. In fact, it would be wonderful if you all will call in next week and talk about what you found if you're searching for the living. So that is going to take place next Thursday, May 3rd, and then May 10th, we're going to have Ann Branshaw. Ann is the author of True Miracles with Genealogy, Help from Beyond the Veil. And my co-host, Natan Kemp, is a contributor to the True Miracles website. And so she's going to share with you her true miracle story, and you just want to hear what she has to say. Not only that, but we're going to also have Sandra Talaferra. Sandra also contributed to the True Miracles with Genealogy book. So I hope that you all will turn in May 10th. That's going to be a 90-minute show, because we have a lot of stories to listen to. And I hope, again, that you will call in to share your true miracle stories. Well, you know, I said that I would try every month to get someone in to discuss genealogical resources in various states. Well, on May 24th, we will have a speaker who will share with us genealogical resources in Tennessee. That's Tina Sasson. Now, I hope that you all will definitely call in to talk to Tina about what's available in Tennessee. And then on May 31st, you don't want to miss this show. Another great-great-granddaughter is coming on, but this time this is the great-great-granddaughter of William Grimes. William Grimes was a runaway slave who wrote the first fugitive slave narrative, and my guest is Regina Mason, and she is calling her title and the topic Reclaiming Grimes, the author of the first slave narrative. So I hope that you all will join me in May for all of these wonderful shows. I also want to mention another show, and this show is coming up on Sunday, and it's Nurturing Our Roots Blog Talk Radio Show with Antoinette Harrell. Antoinette is going to have a show on preserving family heirlooms, treasures, and photographs. That's April 29th at 7 p.m. And, of course, don't forget the African Roots podcast tomorrow morning with Angela Raji, Walton Raji. So, for now, I want to close out and say good night. Thank you so much, so much for joining the show tonight. And thank you, Wilhelmina. And
thank
remember,
you.
Your ancestors left footprints. Therefore, you shall follow the clues that are presented to you through oral history, family records, research at the National Archives, and beyond. Now, we can continue this discussion concerning the local history of Brooklyn communities on afrogenius.com. If you found some resources and you'd like to share that with everyone, again, go to afrogenius.com in the Genealogy and History Forum, and that's where we will continue this discussion about local history. So thank you for joining Research at the National Archives and Beyond. This is your host, Bernice Alexander Bennett. Good night, and I look forward to you joining me next Thursday. And remember, your ancestors left footprints. So I'm going to close out for tonight. Let's listen to a little Summer in New York again. Thank you, Alvin Alexander and friends, for your song. And good night.
In Central Park, hang out on the great lawn, check out concerts there, dance like you just don't care. The bright Harlem lights, Apollo show tonight, there's so much to do. Summer in New York, summer in New York, summer in New York, summer in New York. There's much excitement there. I hate to say it's groovy,
but it's groovy, baby.
On Queens Boulevard, check out shopping malls. That's where our friends meet, sometimes just a week.
Subway to Coney Island for a roller coaster ride. That's where I met you. Summer in New York. Summer in New York. Summer in New York.
Summer in New York.